When the earliest universities were established, the study of astronomy was key to further inquiries into natural philosophy and theology. And over centuries, churchmen made numerous contributions to the field. But by the end of the 19th century, astronomy had become so technical as to be subsumed by physics. And that, along with continued influence from the Enlightenment, resulted in a rift between science and religion. To counter that division, Pope Leo XIII founded a scientific center for astronomy that yielded one of the world's oldest research institutions, the Vatican Observatory. We'll talk about the observatory, the study of the universe, and its relevance to some of our deepest questions just ahead on Media Meet. Hello and welcome to WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guest is acclaimed astronomer and director of the Vatican Observatory, Brother Guy Consolmagno. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Good. Bear with me a minute, a bit of background. You're originally from Detroit and graduated from Detroit Jesuit High School before taking degrees in planetary science at MIT and earning a PhD from University of Arizona's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. You did postdoctoral work and taught at Harvard before spending 2 years in Africa with the Peace Corps, teaching astronomy and physics. You were an assistant professor at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania, then entered the Society of Jesus and took your vows in 1991. You were then assigned to the Vatican Observatory, where you were named director by Pope Francis in 2015. Astronomy in the church apparently have been part of your life from very early on, representing a calling, I'd say. Which came first, and how?
Boy, it's really hard to tell. As a kid, I was fascinated with church and religion, and I was also fascinated with astronomy. And I'm a baby boomer, you can tell from the gray hair. So I started kindergarten the year that Sputnik went up. I graduated high school the year that men landed on the moon. Mm-hmm. And smart little boys in those days were always going to be scientists. Then I went to the Jesuit high school, and they said, oh, you should learn Latin and Greek. All the smart kids do Latin and Greek. Well, I wanted to be one of the smart kids. And I started a year at Boston College thinking maybe I'd be a Jesuit and maybe go into the arts, maybe become a lawyer. I had no idea. I was going to be a newspaper man at one point.
Okay.
My best friend from UD High was going to MIT. MIT had the world's largest collection of science fiction. And when I visited him, I said, this is the place for me. I actually prayed about this, and God said, no, you don't have the personality to be a priest. You know, people come to you with problems, and you want to say, yeah, life's tough when you're stupid. What do you expect? Not good pastoral care. I had the personality to be a nerd. So I went to nerd school, and I loved it. And continued that way, doing the astronomy, until I was well into my 30s. Okay. At that point, it was, okay, you've done this, you're established, you're happiest when you're teaching, now what are you going to do? You know, I'd been dating somebody, and we broke up, and what's my life now? And that thought of being a Jesuit hit me again. I thought maybe I could teach at a Jesuit school, but one of those vows they have you take is obedience. Okay. So instead of being sent to a university to teach, they forced me to go to Italy, eat that terrible food, look at that ugly scenery, and, oh yeah, do whatever research you want to do with 1,000 meteorites in their collection. Okay. And I had to obey.
All right.
Life is tough.
The Jesuit movement dates from 1534 with a pledge from Ignatius of Loyola to reform the church by reforming the individual, as I understand it. Jesuits are known for charitable, missionary, and especially educational works. Yeah. You're the smart guys. Tough on the Reformation, but also a modernizing force within the church. Pope Francis is a Jesuit. How many have become men of science out of that group?
Quite a few. When the first map of the moon was made, Galileo invented the telescope and saw the features.
Sure.
But the first guy to actually make an accurate map was a Jesuit.
Okay.
And he named the craters for famous scientists, including himself and a lot of his Jesuit friends. So on the moon itself are 35 craters named for prominent Jesuit scientists.
Okay.
And all of the universities include math and science as part of the curriculum. This was actually built into the whole Jesuit Studia Rationum.
Okay.
And so The answer really is thousands over the history of the Jesuits. Some of the notable ones was Christopher Clavius, got a crater named for him. The fans of the movie 2001 remember it's Clavius Base they go to.
Okay.
And he was the first guy to really work out a mathematics and a way of teaching mathematics. He also helped reform the calendar. Boscovich devised what we can now call the modern atomic theory. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites, Maximilian Hell, great name for an astronomer, but of course it's the German for bright.
Okay.
And he was one of the guys who observed the transit of Venus and helped work out the size of the solar system from that. Angelo Secchi was the first guy to classify stars by their spectrum. So we've got quite a history.
Secchi comes up quite a bit
in
history of astronomy. Are all the researchers at the Vatican Observatory members of the Jesuit order?
With one exception. Okay. There was an Italian priest who was a friend, and we decided we'd like to include him. So he works in his diocese up in Padua, and he works in the church on Sundays. But then the rest of the week, he's at the University of Padua's astronomical observatory.
Okay.
And 1 week out of four, he comes and stays with us.
Wow. Okay. It's significant that Jesuits are also practical people. I understand astronomy served a very practical purpose in standardizing the liturgical calendar. You mentioned that in 1582. Much as monks developed a clock to keep track of Vespers, the theories of Copernicus and Galileo seem a long way from there. What happened?
Well, they actually used Copernicus's tables and his calculations to reform the calendar.
Would have been about right.
Yeah. You got to remember, the bizarre thing about Copernicus, 1542, mm-hmm. his book comes out. Galileo doesn't get in trouble until 90 years later, 1632. So why did it take 90 years before somebody decided there's something wrong with that?
Yeah.
And the short answer is, everything you know about the Galileo affair is wrong. The truth probably doesn't make the church look any better. But it's not that simple myth, the church was anti-progress, the church was anti-science.
It was a personal thing.
Maybe it was a personal thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was politics going on. The trial of 1632, that year means nothing to us now.
Yeah.
But if I said to you 1969, you have visions of the war in Vietnam, student protests. Mm-hmm. If I said to you 1942, you're immediately thinking World War II.
Sure.
1632 was the height of the 30 Years' War, where it looked like the Spanish were about to be defeated. It looked like the Protestant army was about to invade Italy. And the Spanish were accusing the Pope of being a secret Protestant.
Okay.
And the Pope had to do something to make his, shore up his conservative side. Maybe that had something to do with why he chose that moment to toss his friend Galileo under the bus.
I heard that he was angered. He may have been angered over his role in a set of dialogues.
In the book that Galileo wrote.
He's not treated very complimentary.
And yet the funny thing is,
he looks like an idiot.
when Galileo was on trial, he said to them, basically, what do you want me to change? I'll change it.
Yeah, okay.
And he was told, no, you can't do a deal. We have to find you guilty of something.
Oh.
So you want to find out what's really going on? You want to read a book? There are 400 biographies on Amazon.com. Every one of them is going to tell you a different story. It's one of those wonderful mysteries of history.
Okay. We should point out that astronomy was not the only scientific specialty advanced by Catholic scholars. Maybe you could name a few in other fields.
Certain names.
I mean, we could think Mendel away.
Right, Gregor Mendel, certainly, and the whole gene theory.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of names that we use all the time, Volta was a Catholic, Ampere was a Catholic, Descartes was a Catholic, Laplace was a Catholic. In addition, probably the biggest name that shocks people is Georges Lemaître. Now, this was a Belgian priest. He was not a Jesuit. He hated it. You know, it is possible to be smart, not be a Jesuit.
Okay.
Rare as that might be. He was a diocesan priest in Belgium who was a mathematician in the early 20th century. And he could read Einstein's general theory the way that you could read poetry.
Wow.
And looking at the math, he goes, this means the universe is expanding. And not only that, if it's expanding now than in the past, everything that we see now was compressed in a single point. He called it the primeval atom.
Okay.
But the people who hated this idea made fun of it and called it the Big Bang.
Big Bang, right. The Let's talk about the Vatican Observatory itself. When and why did it come about?
It was a couple of things happening in the 1890s. 1891 was the foundation year. And there was a political side to it. At that point, the Italian government had unified Italy by confiscating church property and confiscating everything except that little territory around the Vatican. And within the Vatican, they wanted to maintain that they were still independent of the government of Italy.
Okay.
So you make your own coins, you make your own postage stamps. And having a national observatory was a sign of nationhood. You say the practical side. Navigators needed to know where the stars were in order to navigate at sea. For that, they needed accurate star charts.
Okay.
The French had devised this idea of photographing the sky and making a photographic atlas. It was too big for any one place to do. So they invited 18 nations, and among the nations was the Vatican City-State, or the Holy See, as it was called then.
They were inviting them to map the stars?
To map a certain section of the stars. So
okay.
Italy had one section, the Vatican had a different section. They're being identified as a country independent. At the same time, though, this was really the rise of that idea that there was a war between science and religion, not just that they had become separated the way you described, which
yeah.
is completely true. But there were people who said the church must be anti-science.
Right.
And a lot of this was political.
Mm-hmm.
The Italian government wanted to discredit the church because it was the one power that could still stand against them.
Sure.
So they invented the myth of Giordano Bruno as that, you know, terrible, terrible person, or the person who was put to death because of his scientific idea.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have been put to death. Nobody should be put to death.
And he was more a mystic than a scientist.
He was more a crank.
Yeah.
If you look him up in Wikipedia and you realize this is not a guy you want to have as your hero of science. He believed in magic. He believed in all sorts of mystic things. But at the same time, the one big scientific idea that was taking the world by storm, H.G. Wells wrote about this all the time, was we can make the world better by eugenics. You know, breed the right people. And fortunately, we know who the right people are, the people who look like you and me.
Yeah,
naturally, not those other people. And the church was, of course, speaking out against eugenics. Eugenics was used as the reason to limit the immigration of Italians into America.
Okay.
The anti-immigration laws of the 1920s.
Right.
And the sterilization laws that were still on the books even into the 1960s. The church was the only outfit opposed to it. And people said, well, that's because the church is anti-science.
Okay.
No, it's because they're anti-bad ideas.
Well, it is true, though, that Giordano was burned at the stake, right?
Yeah.
And this was 30 years before Galileo's trial.
Right.
So, you know, that's going to have a big impact on people's memories, you'd think.
You'd think. You look at the transcript of the trial, you look at the letters people wrote before and after. All of these are available in English, by the way. There's a book by a fellow named Finucchiaro who translated all these things, put them together. Bruno's never mentioned.
Okay.
To them, they didn't make the connection. It's only us moderns that make that connection.
Make the connection. Okay. I'd like to take a moment here to remind our viewers, and especially our radio listeners, that we're talking about the Vatican Observatory and things related to astronomy and science in the church with Vatican Observatory Director, Brother Guy Consolmagno. The facility itself, the Vatican Observatory, seems to have moved around a lot. Now, some of this is to improve the quality of viewing, but it was also nationalized by Italy, wasn't it, at one point?
Not the observatory. What happened was Angelo Secchi, we mentioned before, had telescopes on the roof of a church in Rome. And when Rome was incorporated into the Italian city-state, Secchi's reputation was so great that they let him continue working until he died.
Oh.
And then immediately swiped all of his instruments and moved it over to their observatory.
Okay.
But the Vatican Observatory starts out on the walls around the Vatican, which in 1890, it was still dark enough you could do astronomy at night. By the 1930s, that's impossible. So they moved out to Castel Gandolfo.
And all those things.
And city lights.
Pollution.
Yeah,
right.
Light pollution, which has been the bane everybody has to fight this. So they moved out to Castel Gandolfo. By 1980, the light pollution had reached there. At that point, the director was an American. He'd spent time at the University of Arizona. And so he went to his friends at Arizona and said, can we just buy a house nearby and rent some offices at Stewart Observatory and become part of the observatory? Use your telescopes.
Okay.
That worked great until a fellow named Roger Angel had this bright idea for how to make telescope mirrors. You melt the glass, you put it in a spinning oven, it flows into the shape of a parabola.
Yeah.
So we got the money to make one mirror. It worked. It's great. He then goes to George Coyne, and says, if the Vatican builds a telescope around it, we'll share the telescope and the mirror, which is our telescope today, the Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope.
Okay.
And it's in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And since Roger Angel, you know, was the guy who built it, we can say the Pope's telescope has a mirror made by an angel.
All right. I've read that your work as a scientist is centered... let me ask you this first. What does the Vatican Observatory do most?
We've got a dozen different Jesuits from half a dozen countries, four continents. Every one of them has come in with a doctorate from someplace.
Okay.
And they've come in with a research program and colleagues and ideas. And every one of them works independently. Hmm. So I had an expertise in meteorites. I work on meteorites and asteroids. Right. A fellow named Richard D'Souza just got his doctorate in Germany. He's doing a postdoc right now in Ann Arbor. And his expertise is in galaxies.
Okay.
So he works with the people in Ann Arbor doing galaxies. We've got a fellow who got his degree from Western Ontario, from African originally. And in Western Ontario, they're experts in meteors. That's what he does. The idea is not that we have a big program. When I arrived 25 years ago, George Coyne, the director, said to me, do good science.
Sure.
Which is more freedom than I ever had when I was working on NASA grants.
Okay.
I don't have to apply for grant money. Yeah. I don't have to sit in front of a committee. I don't have to justify what I'm doing. If it's good science, it speaks for itself.
Yeah, being a Jesuit, you go where the truth takes you, right?
That's the whole point of it, really. If we're doing this to glorify God and God is the truth, then you can't be afraid of the truth.
Okay.
If you're afraid of the truth, you have no faith in your faith.
I see.
But there is one thing
that
makes us different. Because I don't have to worry about tenure, because I don't have to worry about getting my grant renewed every 3 years, I can do long-term projects. The measurement of meteorite density, porosity, other physical properties, it's been taken 20 years. We have the book of data that everybody else uses, but nobody else had bothered to take that data because it took 20 years to pull it together.
Okay.
We've got guys who are doing surveys of galaxies or surveys of peculiar stars. There's no way you could get funded on a 3-year cycle to do that. It's the work of a lifetime.
Wow.
So we try to do work that complements the work of our friends and colleagues.
Okay. I've read that your work, you'd mentioned it here, centers on meteorites, asteroids, and small bodies in our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like end of the world stuff.
It's actually beginning of the world stuff.
Okay.
These are the lumps that are 4.5 billion years old that have witnessed the origin of the solar system, and in both their chemistry and their physical state, they tell us what things went on when the planets were forming. So they're the ground truth.
Okay.
And if you can understand how the asteroids were made, if you can understand how the little moons, you know, the moons of Jupiter were made, then you have some confidence that your theories for planet formation can then be applied to the bigger planets.
Okay. Astronomy and astrophysics work isn't cheap. You'd mentioned you don't have to worry about grants.
Mm-hmm.
Who has the ultimate authority over the operation? How is it paid for?
Well, I'm appointed directly by Pope Francis, so I don't have to answer to anyone else in the church except the Pope.
Wow.
Which is fabulous. And it's kind of scary. He knows who I am. You know, that's fascinating. The work that we do has to be published in the same scientific journals as anyone else. So mm-hmm. we know if it's good work or bad work,
right.
depending on what the referee is. It's all peer reviewed.
Yeah.
Beyond that, the Vatican pays about $1.5 million a year for our budget, which for a dozen people is darn cheap because Jesuits come cheap. We're the ultimate dinks. You know, a dink, dual income, no kids? Well, we're 12 incomes, no kids. So we can live cheap.
But you don't get paid anything, so that brings the cost down considerably.
Exactly, exactly. And they own the house we live in, and they pay the utility bills.
Okay.
The other thing, though, is that we've got this telescope in Arizona, and we've got a big program to not only do astronomy, but show the world. Pope Leo XIII said, we're there to show the world that the church supports science.
Okay.
So we got to do the science, we got to show the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, we've got a foundation, a Vatican Observatory Foundation,
Okay.
incorporated in Arizona. And it does things ranging from a website called The Catholic Astronomer, where we just talk about what's going on in astronomy. We've got another website on faith and science for Catholic educators who want to look for resources that they can use in their classrooms.
Okay.
We, of course, show up at a lot of science outreach programs. We have a summer school we run for students in Rome every 2 years. We've got a program we try to run every year or every 2 years in Tucson. I even go to science fiction conventions and talk about it there. Anything that can bring the gospel of astronomy, if you want, mm-hmm. that astronomy is fantastic. It's a way of knowing the Creator. And even if you don't believe in God, go look at the stars and be amazed and get pulled out of yourself.
Sure.
It's the first step to spirituality.
Okay. Pope Francis has said in that vein that faith enriches science. Those are his words I pulled mm-hmm. from something. You've written over 40 scholarly papers. You published a number of books, including a wonderful book that's kind of an introduction to astronomy, Turn Left at Orion. Is
yep.
that the one?
That's okay. it, yeah.
You've traveled, taught, lectured. You became the first Jesuit, I'm sure, to receive the American Astronomical Society's Carl Sagan Medal.
Mm-hmm.
And you even have an asteroid named after you.
Yes, right.
Little Guy for short.
I told my dad, you're not getting grandkids from me, but I'll give you an asteroid, you know, something to carry your name.
How do you view your scientific work in relation to your faith and your duties as a, you know, within the Jesuit order?
There is a temptation to keep these in separate boxes mm-hmm. and to think they don't mix. There's the alternate temptation to use one as a substitute for the other. I don't have to pray because my work is my prayer. That's BS.
Okay.
It's not true. You have to pray. You have to spend time stepping back and going, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Where should I be? Mm-hmm. Am I on the right path? For me, though, my faith gives me the reason to do my science. You know, people will ask, why does the Vatican have an observatory? Why does anybody have an observatory? Mm-hmm. Why do they teach astronomy at Northern Michigan? And the reason has to be more than just it's going to put food on the table or it's going to make me rich and famous. You know, it didn't make me rich and famous.
Yeah.
The reason we do this is at the very beginnings because we're human beings who are curious. We're hungry for more than just food. We're hungry to feed our souls. Beyond that, what gives me the confidence that I can even do science? If I were an ancient Roman pagan, I wouldn't ask, why does lightning strike? I knew why. You know, the god of lightning did it.
Sure.
When you get rid of all those pagan gods, you open up the world to ask the questions, okay, if it wasn't Zeus, who was it? If you believe in a universe that was created by God deliberately and at every moment says, this is good, then not only do you see understanding this creation as a way of getting close to the Creator? You know, every mom who puts the picture of their kids' kindergarten drawings on the refrigerator is doing that because it reminds them of the one they love.
Okay.
Well, you know, you look at the stars and that's God's refrigerator door if you want. Beyond that, by saying that this is an expression of God, we not only motivate why I want to do it, but why our society should support a few people like me to be able to tell the rest of you what's going on in space, why it's fun, why it's exciting. Because if we didn't have an entire community behind us, we'd have no way to learn from other people, we'd have no way to pass it on. We need universities.
Right.
We need, not only that, we need churches where if a kid says, I want to go into geology, they're not ashamed of him.
Okay.
They rather say, that's wonderful. You're going to get to see God in a way that most of us don't get to see.
Okay.
And not all churches say that, which is a tragedy.
All right. Our expectations for hard science have issued some big questions. I'd like to get some very short answers on a few of these. One is, what do we know about the very beginnings of the universe and its evolution?
We know the universe is expanding, and we can look into the past two ways.
Mm-hmm.
We got stuff from the past, those meteorites I was talking about, and we have light from really distant galaxies that took 10 or 12 billion years to get from there to us. With this evidence, we can put some constraints on what the universe must have been like in the first billion years, the first few hundred million years.
Okay.
And we know that if everything that is now spread out to where it is was all collected together in a really tiny space, the energy density had to be really high. That's what you call a temperature. Mm-hmm. That's so. It had to be a different kind of physics. Okay. And at that point, you have lots of fun extrapolating from the physics we have now to what might it have been like then. So we know that the universe was different in the past. And we know that it's accelerating now. The space between the galaxy clusters is not only growing, but growing at an ever faster rate. We have no idea where it's going, because we don't have any data from the future.
Okay.
The best you can do is say, well, if it keeps on this way, but you know, nothing ever keeps on that way forever.
Right. Here's one that I think has become more and more on people's minds as various discoveries are made. Are there planets like Earth relevant to whether or not we're alone out here, or is it just us?
You know, 20 years ago, if you'd asked me, I'd have given you the science fiction fan's answer. I hope so.
Okay.
I don't have to say that anymore. We have in our database about 2,000 stars that we know have planets. Hundreds of them are planets that are resembling Earth in their size, and those are hard to find, and yet we still find them lots of places. We find planets like Earth that are in regions around their stars where you would expect water would be stable as liquid, mm-hmm. which is one of the things we need to know for life. I'll have to say this. If there isn't life out there, it sure is a waste of space. I wish I could claim that was an original line, but I swiped that from Carl Sagan.
Okay. We made an implicit reference at some point to, I think, to one of St. Peter's letters that said the apocalypse is in the future.
This, yep.
When we talked about end of the world mm-hmm. stuff. And scientists seem to agree that it's just a question of when some planetary body destroys life on Earth, as it occurred with the dinosaurs. So,
or the sun will eventually go into a red giant phase or whatever. Again, extrapolating from what we know in the past, it seems like a reasonable bet.
Well, as a matter of, as a matter of living and working through all this mm-hmm. thing, any advice?
Well, the longer we know ahead of time, the more we can do something about it. If there was an asteroid on a collision course and we could calculate that it was going to hit in 100 years' time, we could go there now and fiddle it to slightly nudge it out of its orbit. The orbits are never perfect. We can never be sure. The one thing you don't want to do is send Bruce Willis up there with a bomb.
Okay.
Because, right now it may have a 50% chance of hitting the Earth. You blow it up and there's a 100% chance that half of it will hit the Earth.
Okay.
It's not an improvement. On the other hand, if it's just a comet and it's just coming and we have a few months' notice, not a whole lot you can do about that.
Yeah.
But at least by doing an inventory of the solar system now, we would have a better chance of knowing what's out there and how to prepare for it. And in the short term, if you're worried about this, two things I recommend.
Okay.
Quit smoking and wear your seatbelt, because those things are a whole lot more likely to kill you.
All right. That's excellent. We've been talking with the director of the Vatican Observatory, Brother Guy Consolmagno, about the observatory, astronomy, and other things related to science. Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Hart. See you next time on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.